Let's look at what happens in the demolition industry. Taking down large structures requires preparation. Powerful explosives and heavy equipment are used in advance to weaken the foundation and bottom sections of a building before additional explosives and gravity bring the rest of it down. The words of a senior blaster.
We blow the basement, all the columns in the basement. Then we crack it up at the top to get it started. We go every other floor, all the way down. Every explosive has a timer on it, that's why it's controlled. When the columns go, each floor goes down and impacts the one below and keeps going.
Here's what demolition experts use in steel-framed buildings. The linear-shaped charge.
It's a chevron-shaped or V-shaped charge that you can focus on a specific target, and it's lethal. It generates around 3 million pounds per square inch pressure at a speed, depending on the explosive inside the shaped charge, in excess of 27,000 feet per second.
Besides the unfathomably powerful shaped charge, blasters have a lot of tricks.
There are over 1,000 different types of explosive. Different because they detonate at varying speeds.
This is detonating cord, and this burns at about 21,000 feet per second. Comes in all colors, pastels too.
With the use of delays, we can control pretty much where the debris lands. We can control vibration. We can control noise levels. Timing and delays are the key to just about everything in our business.
And what is the result?
The thing that pleases me is the fragmentation and the control. When to take a building and break it up into millions of pieces and put it in this basement as artfully as we do it, and it works like just like clockwork. So we've got it all down to a science. It gives me goosebumps to talk about it.
With the underground explosions intended to blow out the Twin Towers' basements, followed by blasts heard inside the buildings of shape charges slicing the core.
Because of the secondary explosion, we've got numerous people covered with dust from the secondary explosion.
Demolition pre-weakening usually takes place well in advance of the final blast, but at the World Trade Center, critical prep work might have had to occur in a very compressed time frame in the panicked aftermath of the plane strikes. These core columns were discovered after the collapse. The angled cut occurs in exactly the manner that shaped charges slice through steel beams to control the way they fall. Notice the hardened, once liquid metal. Was thermite used with the shaped charge?
The job of the shaped charge is to cut steel H-beams.
The way we do this is by cutting the beam at an angle, which through a series of beams cut at the same angle will tend to make the building shift over and walk.
Let's look at the rubble of two 110-story buildings brought to the ground. In a 7-story crater lie nearly 2 million tons of debris. Had the basements not been blown out, where would 2 million tons have gone? Heaped on the ground, ready to slide and spill? The art of controlled demolition. Remember the pre-collapse and mid-collapse explosions caught by Richard Siegel's camera on the Jersey Shore? Were these the blasts that took out the core and upper basements just before the final crumble, a mind-boggling sequence of computer-controlled delays that blew the exoskeleton, pulverized the concrete, to bring the whole structure rolling to the ground? Was this the story of that day?
Inside our building, the North Tower, we heard pa 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 pa. And
it's
on
the book, it's the smoke that's coming from the city. Folks stepping out of bodegas and stores to look.
Some people appear to have known the imminent future on that fateful day. FEMA had arrived in New York on Monday night, ready for a bioterror drill. Spokesman Tom Kenny to Dan Rather.
To be honest with you, we arrived on late Monday night and went into action on Tuesday morning. And not until today did we get a full opportunity to work the entire site other than the spot at church and day to which we were deployed.
And Rudy Giuliani, mayor of New York, tells ABC's Peter Jennings that he was aware the towers would be coming down.
What's going on now is a massive rescue effort.
Do you believe it's hundreds or thousands?
I really don't want to say right now, Peter. I think it's going to be a horrible number. I saw people jumping out of the World Trade Center. I saw some of the firefighters who I know going into the building, so... And we were in a building in which we were trapped for about 10, 15 minutes. And we set up headquarters at 75 Barclay Street, which was right there with the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, the head of emergency management. And we were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. The World Trade Center was going to collapse. It was going to collapse. It was going to collapse.
Similarly, Larry Silverstein, new leaseholder of the World Trade Center, regretfully declared that a decision was made to pull Building 7 by the end of the day, the last structure added to the World Trade Center complex. Let's hear Mr. Silverstein's actual words, delivered for our benefit in the 2002 PBS documentary America Rebuilds.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
Blast, shoot, blow, and pull are terms used in the demolition industry to refer to bringing down buildings, bridges, and other structures.
Because I actually blew the hospital down that I was born in.
Originally, we had figured to shoot it, let it drop straight down.
Then, watch Demolition Dynamics attempt a big blast.
And from Ground Zero's own post-disaster wrecking crew.
By mid-December, the Department of Design and Construction had leveled World Trade Center buildings 4 and 5.
Getting ready to pull Building 6.
Silverstein, a commercial real estate tycoon with international political connections, acquired a 99-year lease on the World Trade Center complex in the spring of 2001. Throughout the summer, he reworked the insurance policies on his new property, making sure that it was covered for acts of terrorism. Explicit in the lease agreement was Silverstein's right to rebuild the complex if it were destroyed. After 9/11, Mr. Silverstein fought his insurers in court to obtain double his policy limits for the destruction of his property, maintaining that the double hijacking constituted two disasters caused by terrorists, not just one. He won and was awarded over $7 billion, a magnificent return on his original $15 million investment.
My first reaction is to think about the families of those people, the tragedy, the magnitude of it. However, I firmly believe that we should rebuild.
Just in the last few seconds, another building, building number 7, one of the buildings in support of the World Trade Center towers, has collapsed.
World Trade 7, functioning as the command center for the complex, housed giant diesel backup and oxygen systems, the mayor's protected emergency bunker, and offices for the CIA, Secret Service, Department of Defense, and Securities and Exchange Commission. Its other tenants were insurance companies, brokerages, and banks. No plane hit Building 7, but at 5:20 p.m. on September 11th, it collapsed in a heap on the ground. Some damage to Building 7 is said to have been caused by debris from Tower 1. Though this New York Times article tells us Building 7 burned like a giant torch, the only visuals that exist are of unidentified smoke and a few small fires. Compare this to the wallop sustained by World Trade Center 3, 4, 5, and 6. Positioned right below the towers, damage to the surrounding World Trade Center buildings was infinitely worse. Still, the structures held up. But somehow, rescue workers knew that Building 7 would fall.
You hear that?
Keep your eye on that building. It'll be coming down soon.
A 47-story skyscraper, Building 7 folded neatly in 6.5 seconds. A textbook descent right into its footprint. Silverstein Properties now tells us that its owner was referring to the team of firefighters inside the building when he spoke of the decision to pulling the firemen out of harm's way. However, there were no firefighters in Building 7, according to FEMA, NIST, and Fire Chief Frank Fellini. They were ordered out at 11:30 that morning. 6 hours later, the building came down.
You know, we heard this sound that sounded like a clap of thunder. Turned around, it looked like there was a shockwave ripping through the building and the windows all busted out, and you know, it was horrifying. About a second later, the bottom floor caved out, and the building followed after that.
Radio host Alex Jones notes the mark of a classic implosion.
This is a photo taken 1 second into Building 7's collapse. Notice the crimp. If we look at other controlled demolitions, we see that they first blow one of the central columns so the building falls in on itself. If you don't do this, the building falls outward and can damage surrounding structures. Building 7 had a classic crimp or wedge. Its central column was blown out first, so it didn't structurally damage buildings just a few feet away from it.
Remember the mayor's emergency bunker? Ensconced on the 23rd floor of Building 7, it was retrofitted with superglass, water, oxygen, and its own generator. But Mayor Giuliani chose to find emergency shelter elsewhere on September 11th. Why Building 7? Even the media and its experts were confused. The History Channel interviews structural engineer Ramon Gilsans, who points out the obvious crimp and even speaks of the implosion.
Engineers are not just focusing on the Twin Towers. The most disturbing structural event was not that the Twin Towers fell, but that Tower 7, ignited by flying debris, fell due to fire alone.
Building 7 was a steel frame building, and is the first steel frame building that has collapsed due to fire. The failure of the building was an implosion. It failed completely different than Towers 1 and 2, in which the floors failed first.
Why Building 7? Let's ask the question again. As the WTC Command Center, was it the hub for the 9/11 plan? Also, in 6.5 seconds, lost forever were thousands of SEC case files on corporate fraud, including those relating to the notorious activities of giants WorldCom and Enron. A few indictments for stock fraud. But what of the $70 billion California electricity swindle? It disappeared. No one died in the collapse of Building 7. It was vacated well in advance of its implosion, but not the Twin Towers. Why weren't police, firemen, and civilians in these buildings told what to expect? Tragically, employees in the towers were advised to return to their offices.
The announcement came on that everything was fine.
Tower 1, they were evacuating, but Tower 2 was fine, and we could go back to our offices.
We're about to go through the turnstile. The security guard says, where you guys are going? I said, well, I'm going home because I saw fireballs coming down. He said, no, your building is safe. It's secured. It is safer to stay in your building. Go back to your office.
Stanley Priamnath returned to the 81st floor. Then?
I just happened to raise my head looking straight towards the Statue of Liberty. And what I saw was a giant airplane coming straight towards me.
The South Tower was hit between the 78th and 84th floors. Trapped on the 81st floor by crushing debris, Stanley was rescued by Brian Clark. Slowly and painfully, they made their way down a stairwell to freedom. Outside, Stanley had a feeling of uncanny prescience for what was to come.
And we peered through the railing, up through the trees at the tower, and Stanley said, you know, I think that tower could come down.
And I don't know why I'm telling this man this building is going, but I knew it was not over.
I said, there's no way. That's a steel structure. That's just draperies and carpets and furniture burning. You know, there's no way. And I didn't finish my sentence when the tower started to slide. And I can still remember hearing, first of all, this boom, boom, boom explosion.
Not all were blessed with intuition or foresight. Joseph Milanovic reached his son Greg by cell phone.
Greg at that time, I could tell by his voice, was scared. He said to me, Dad, can you get in touch with someone and tell them that there's about 20 of us on the northeast corner of the 93rd floor?
Greg had been about to leave the South Tower after the North Tower was attacked, but was told it was safer to return to his desk.
A couple of times he said, why did I listen? Why did I listen?
Who was a director in the company that provided electronic security for the World Trade Center and Washington's Dulles Airport, both involved in September 11th? None other than the president's younger brother. From 1996 to 2000, SecureCom installed what was referred to as a new security system at the World Trade Center. Wirt D. Walker III, a cousin of the Bush brothers, was CEO of SecureCom from 1999 until 2002. Interestingly, these facts have not been made public. Was it only a security system that was added during those years, or was it also the wiring for a long-awaited plan? Scott Forbes, an IT specialist in a firm that had leased space in the South Tower since its erection, reported an unprecedented power down in his building for almost the whole weekend prior to 9/11.
We were notified 3 weeks in advance of the power down by the Port Authority. That was relatively short notice to plan to shut down all of our banking systems. It was a big deal. It was unprecedented. We had a data center on the 97th floor. So our originating servers were all there. During that weekend, the power down meant that there was no security. The doors were all open, basically. And also the security video cameras were all off. But they were guys in overalls carrying huge toolboxes and reels of cables walking around the building on that weekend.
Employees were notified that internet cables were being upgraded. But who were the strange workmen, and what were they really doing?
All the power was shut down. If there was a power down, that meant that everything was gone in terms of security, in terms of access to the building. So anybody could have gone there and do any kind of setup.
Having worked overtime to get his company's servers back up, Scott took the day off on September 11th. As he watched the towers collapse from New Jersey that morning, he was sure this had been the purpose of the mysterious weekend work. Scott notified many authorities, including the 9/11 Commission, about the unusual and lengthy power outage, but was ignored. Ben Fountain of Fireman's Fund spoke of unusual evacuations ordered at the Twin Towers during the weeks before September 11th. Others reported that the security alert was inexplicably lifted 5 days prior and bomb-sniffing dogs were removed. What would the dogs have discovered had they remained on duty? Not long after the disaster, Lower Manhattan saw banners like this one. Although they were idolized as cathedral-like symbols of power and triumph that pierced the New York skyline, the Twin Towers were big money losers for the Port Authority of New York. They cost millions a year to equip with the basics: electricity, water, heat, air conditioning, sewage, and even oxygen, being airtight. As modern communications connected traders from all corners of the globe, tenancy in the Twin Towers continued to drop. The towers presented another problem. Decades ago, their steel beams had been sprayed with fireproof asbestos, a cancer-causing material banned from use in building in the mid-1980s. Although the World Trade Center complex was given several waivers, it was expected to clean up its act. But to remove the asbestos from every supporting beam in the Twin Towers would have been almost undoable. Quotes for this cleanup ran over $1 billion, and no insurance company was willing to bear the cost. An urban renewal project of unfathomable proportions. Given the towers' issues and problems, September 11th proved an unexpected bonanza. The Trade Center was built in the 1960s to revive a rundown area of New York, and 40 years later, urban renewal could again take place. Two white elephants were removed, and a brand new complex is in the works. The full height of the new Freedom Tower will soar to 1,776 feet. The suffocating dust that engulfed Manhattan was much more than dust. It was pulverized concrete, glass, metals, containing lead, mercury, dioxins, benzene, and of course, asbestos. None of that was healthy for any living thing. Today, thousands of rescue workers have developed lung cancer and serious permanent health conditions. And the rescue dogs continue to die.
What you had was a ground-level municipal incinerator that smoldered for months, burning up the most heavily computerized building in the world. Patients have had black paste coming out of their pores. They have reported bowel movements that are blue or green and have smelled like smoke, despite the fact that they have not been at a fire scene for months.
Only 3 days after September 11th, Washington instructed the EPA to declare Manhattan safe and reopen Wall Street, though the air remained toxic.
A federal judge is blasting the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency for telling New Yorkers it was safe to return to their homes and offices near Ground Zero soon after the 9/11 attacks. The judge called Christine Todd Whitman's actions, quote, conscious shocking, and refused to grant her immunity.
It was documented that the White House ordered EPA to tell these lies, to downplay the seriousness of the environmental hazards.
In addition, 9/11 first responders who have fallen ill and applied for aid have been denied. Asbestos plays a part in the myth of why the Twin Towers fell on September 11th.
The steel had been sprayed with a lightweight fireproof foam, which, while cheaper, was much less adhesive. The New York Times has reported that the foam fell off easily, and the Port Authority had been fixing and replacing missing sections in the months before September 11th. But even if the fireproofing had been perfectly applied, the impact of the plane crashing into the North Tower was so powerful It simply blew most of it off, allowing the fire to attack the steel beneath.
Once the planes hit, whatever condition it was in before the fact, made no difference because an impact would knock it off and the fire would have devastating effects on the steel.
One good smack from a jet plane and the puffs of asbestos are all blown off the steel. Would a few hundred doors slamming do the same thing? Here, the History Channel tells us how, due to poor fireproofing, flames swept through the pockets between floors.
As much of the fireproofing had been dislodged on impact, the flames were attacking unprotected steel.
When steel is not protected, the strength reduces very fast. When you get to about 1100 degrees Fahrenheit, you lose about half the strength of the steel.
The fire inside the towers may have reached temperatures of 2500 degrees Fahrenheit. The New York Times has reported what happened to those steel floor trusses then.
The steel did heat up, and it became softer and softer, almost like licorice. And eventually, all the steel had been weakened in this zone.
40 years ago, the steel used to build the World Trade Center was certified by Underwriters Laboratories, a global product compliance and public safety guardian. Let's hear a lone voice that spoke out from this enormous company.
My name is Kevin Ryan, and I'm formerly a manager at Underwriters Laboratories. I was fired from my job 5 days after sending a letter to a government scientist at the NIST questioning the report that the NIST had recently released in October of 2004. I wrote this letter because I had serious questions about what I saw in the report. Those questions went back to September of 2001 when UL's CEO came to our location in South Bend. He told our entire staff that the World Trade Center steel had been certified by UL, and he said that we should be proud of how long the buildings had stood. Over the next 2 years, I did some research and found some very disturbing facts, including that the steel had been disposed of in an unprecedented manner. Once I discovered those facts, I sent a written question to UL CEO asking him about these things and what he was doing to protect our reputation as a company. He replied in writing to me that UL did, in fact, test the steel. He talked about the quality of the sample and how well it had performed in the tests. And he said that our company had tested the steel and that it had done beautifully. After that, he asked me to be patient and wait for the NIST report because UL was working closely with them. I saw this report in October of 2004, and in November, I sent my letter to NIST asking for clarification. I felt it was an obligation on my part to ask the questions, since no one else seemed to care to. After the 1993 bombing, the fireproofing in both buildings was updated considerably. But when you look at the NIST report, you don't see any testing that showed that a 767 would widely dislodge the fireproofing under any impact, let alone so far from the point of impact. So now we've been left with a new theory that is not really a theory at all, but only a collection of vague statements. The NIST report represents what can really only be called anti-science. They started with their conclusions and worked their way back to some leading hypotheses. When the results of the physical tests showed that the temperatures were far too low to soften steel, and that the floors could not have collapsed, and that the fireproofing could not have been widely dislodged, the NIST ignored these results and built a black box computer model that no one can argue with and that would spit out the right answers. Today, anyone who's conscious enough to know what's happening in the world knows that most government policy is being driven by this false story.
Crack down and punish the perpetrators of this attack. This is being seen on Capitol Hill as another Pearl Harbor, as another Pearl Harbor, as another Pearl Harbor.
The steel in dragon-like lengths and contortions spoke for itself. Bent, deformed, without cracks.
I found it hard to believe that it actually bent because of the size of it and how there's no cracks in the iron. It bent without almost a single crack in it. It takes thousands of degrees to bend steel like this.
Typically, you'd have buckling and tearing on the tension side, but there's no buckling at all. There's
no buckling at all.
Here is the meteorite, molten iron fused with concrete.
And architects, engineers, people who work with steel, welders, have just never seen the level of destruction and the level of deformation of this material in our lives.
It is true that heat expands steel. In a fire, steel members may swell and bend slightly. But this, how could these huge tangles have been created? The steel below the towers had melted at many thousands of degrees. Since metal conducts heat, were these twisted remains formed by high temperatures wicking their way through a gridwork of steel? Explosives also deform steel. As they fire, gas pushes outward. The force of the gas can easily bend a large steel column. Two kinds of debris, huge shattered columns that could break a truck, combined with matter that was near pulverized.
You have two 110-story office buildings. You don't find a desk. You don't find a chair. You don't find a telephone, a computer. The biggest piece of a telephone I found was half of the keypad, and it was about this big.
In 1886, four gold miners lost their lives in an underground explosion. The bodies of these four men were brought to the surface in one barrel. The biggest piece recovered was part of a foot. September 11th left over 1,100 bodies unaccounted for. At Ground Zero, this was found inside a length of steel.
And before they sealed this up with the sheetrock and all the building materials on the interior face, the workers would sometimes put beer cans and the newspaper that we found, the New York Times paper, was we found in a similar spot to this.
Secrets cannot be kept forever. Just as that newspaper from 1969 revealed itself to us decades later, we will someday know the inside of September 11th. The reasons for the staging of such a production go far back into time. Insurance policies covered nearly everything in the World Trade Center that was destroyed. But what if certain commodities could be removed in the nick of time? Gold and silver held by commercial banks and the COMEX exchange is said to have been stored beneath Ground Zero. This single cache belonging to the Bank of Nova Scotia was unearthed and made public. Was there more, and was it removed, remains a question. As last survivor William Rodriguez climbed the stairwell to rescue people, he remembers a very strange thing.
As I stood there on the 33rd floor, I heard very strange noises on the 34th floor. Now, the 34th floor was an empty floor, a floor that did not have any kind of walls, or it was a construction floor. It was totally hollowed out. There was nothing there, and I heard very heavy equipment being moved around. And it sounded like dumpsters with metal wheels being moved around, and I got scared because I knew it was an empty floor. Nobody was supposed to be there. As a matter of fact, not even the elevators stopped there. You have to have a special access key to open the door on the 34th floor. So to find that there were strange noises there, and I continue actually bypassing that floor because I didn't dare to open the door on the 34th floor.
Something told William Rodriguez not to mess with the 34th floor. I got scared. Yet William Rodriguez was not a man who was scared that day. He remained in a burning building against firemen's orders, endangering his own life as he saved the lives of others. What could have been happening on the 34th floor? For weeks, Scott Forbes had heard similar noises on the 98th floor above him.
It must have been at least 4 to 6 weeks before 9/11. It was like rebuilding work going on upstairs. The tenants, the people from Aon who had been were moved somewhere else, the offices were just vacant. And there was a lot of heavy machinery building work going on. It was almost like pneumatic drills and lots of hammering, so much so that the floors were shaking. That's how noticeable it was. It was almost as if something heavy was being moved and then it was being taken off wheels and it was like, boom, our floor underneath literally shook. You could feel the weight above you. That was how large it was. On one occasion, I opened a door to see what was going on, being nosy. When I opened the door, the whole office space was empty. There was nothing there at all. It was quite bizarre because it was just empty. Completely empty, barren, nothing, zero. Not even cables hanging from the ceiling, but there'd been these heavy noises and vibrations up above. It was really strange.
And the noticeable dust in the building the week before.
It was probably the week leading up to 9/11. Every morning I'd come in around 7 a.m. and the dust was incredible. It was filthy. It was like the cleaners weren't cleaning. Right where the windows were, there was a sill which enclosed radiators. I was sick to death of the dust which was appearing on the windowsills. It was dirty gray and very, very noticeable in that week leading up to 9/11. Where was that dust coming from?
Gray dust Scott himself had to clean. Was it powdered cement? The steel columns of the Twin Towers formed an endo and exoskeleton. Had something been placed around the edge of the building? Holes been drilled to contain it? Was the dust in those final days a telltale sign? As white elephants, the buildings were full of vacant offices. Tenants could be temporarily moved around for upgrades as Aon was, and a plan arranged to perfection. Was the strange construction that could be heard but not seen going on all over the towers? Larry Silverstein took possession 6 weeks before September 11th, when the strange construction began. Were the sounds that scared William Rodriguez the last of the rats as they left a sinking ship? By taking a day off, Scott Forbes saved his life. This woman was not so fortunate. She is 9/11's Iphigenia, calling soundlessly to people who could not help her. Christopher Hanley, trapped with 100 people on the 106th floor of Tower 1.
Fire Department 408, where's the fire?
Yeah, hi. I'm on the 106th floor of the World Trade Center. We just had an explosion up here.
What building are you in, sir? One or
number
two?
One World Trade.
All right.
Yeah, there's smoke, and we got about 100 people up here.
Sit tight. Do not leave, okay? There's a fire or an explosion or something in the building. All right, I want you to stay where you are.
Yes.
Kevin Cosgrove, trapped on the 105th floor of the South Tower.
There's smoke. Right there. 105, 2-5. It's really bad. It's black. It's iron. My wife thinks I'm all right. I called her and said I was leaving the building. I was fine. And I'm bang. Two, three of us. Two broken windows. Oh, God!
Let's not forget these people whose fate on this day was decided for them. As we know, secrets cannot be kept forever.
When I reach the place I'm going, I will surely know my way, and I will turn and look inside me and bid farewell to one more day. Every light begins with darkness. Every flower is one to see. And with the sun when to taste us, we are bound to be released. I will fly. I will surely know my way. I will surely.